Today at Reader's Corner, photographer Matthew Darren, author of A Forgotten Wilderness, Nature's Hidden Relationship in West Central Idaho.
I basically did a radius around McCall to hit all areas, but what's more important is the elevation of the photographs. In the winter, the low elevation, steep, inaccessible, that's where I photographed. Our animals are well hunted, and therefore they have the natural fear of humans. Every trip was hand shot and remote camera shot. So I'd set up the remote cameras, then I would go track, I'd go call in or set up. This is a book that takes the direct patterns of nature and connects directly with the audience, with no ego of a photographer or naturalist.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Where the wet Pacific slope meets the drier continental inland, a unique ecosystem supports an abundance of wildlife, birds, and plants. Residents of West Central Idaho have long appreciated the rich diversity of the region. And a new book by Idaho photographer Matthew Darren is introducing this treasure to nature lovers far beyond our borders. A Forgotten Wilderness, Nature's Hidden Relationship in West Central Idaho, offers a fascinating glimpse into this beautiful part of our state. By backpacking into the hidden reaches of West Central Idaho over a period of more than 2 years and setting up a series of motion-triggered cameras, Mr. Darren captured amazing photos of elk, wolves, mountain lions, birds, coyotes, and other animals in all seasons of the year. His accompanying text describes why the area is unique, the type of flora and fauna it supports, and how these various forms of life interact with one another and with us. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Matthew Darren. A Forgotten Wilderness is sponsored by Brundage Mountain Resort and River Ranch in McCall. Mr. Darren joined us in the studio for this interview. Matthew Darren, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you.
Well, this is the one show, Matthew, where I wish we had video instead of just audio,
yeah,
because I'd be able to show off your book. And what's interesting about your book is that for our listeners who have not seen it, the first glance of it, it looks like what we call one of those coffee table books that looks so beautiful sitting on the coffee table where you page through it, look at all the great photos. But of course, it's so much more than that because the text and the background you've provided to the photography you shot is really the work of a naturalist. And I guess I have to ask, how does an engineer become a naturalist?
Well, basically, environmental engineering is actually the study of replicating natural systems. It's kind of replicating the economy of a natural system. So in a sense, it's an artificial system, but you need to understand the natural system behind it. And so wildlife biology, botany was very important in that field. And once I studied that background, it's kind of it becomes an addictive hobby, mm-hmm, kind of like bird watching and so forth.
Sure.
And you are correct. It's interesting that you bring up the coffee table idea, because when working on the project, we had discussed how most nature books are coffee table format, where you flip through it once and you're kind of excited by the photos, but there's never much reason to open it again. You've already seen the static photos. And I felt this area, already overlooked and arguably the most important natural area in North America, deserved a deeper treatment about relationships of nature, what it means to be natural. Because this is one of our last massive temperate wilderness areas left in North America, probably in the world. And I say temperate because there's obviously Arctic and subarctic wildernesses, but it's very different when you have a temperate, four-season, well-watered area. Mm-hmm.
So let's say we're looking at a state of Idaho map. Define this area for us about what you're talking.
Okay. South of Boise, you're very strongly in the Great Basin continental region. North of Lewiston, you're strongly in the Pacific. So everything between Boise and Lewiston is this transition area I'm talking about, the area that has both Pacific Northwest straight up to Alaska, or consequently the Great Basin straight down to northern Mexico. Mm-hmm. So this transition area also coincidentally happens to fall upon this central Idaho block of wilderness, the largest temperate wilderness left in North America. Mm-hmm. So we have two different things going on, a transition that has all the elements of North America and the largest block. Mm-hmm.
So would you say that McCall is somewhat the center of this area?
McCall is somewhat the center because as you go east toward Ketchum, Salmon, Challis, each range creates a rain shadow that causes the dry continental. So it's only in that area between, say, Yellow Pine and the Snake River that you're getting the mix. You're getting the right moisture to have a little bit of the Pacific, but not too much.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a pretty strong statement you made earlier about the uniqueness of this region. I mean, just to the east of us is Yellowstone National Park, which everyone would think is the national treasure on the face of the earth, at least the American earth.
Right.
And yet, how do you compare that to this, or this to that, I should say?
Yeah, and that's one of the impetuses or one of the motivations for this book was noticing the diversity and abundance drop in a place like Yellowstone, even though it gets all the attention. Let me give you an example. To photograph the mountain lions, which is the hardest large carnivore to photograph, nocturnal, it's not anything that can habituate with people. I needed to live out in the winter and track them, find where they were moving, and then set up the hidden cameras there. When you're doing that in west central Idaho, you're doing it on low elevation, steep slopes that have very little snowfall, very little wind, and mild temperatures. By mild, I mean 10 to 15 degrees. When you go over to Yellowstone, you are dealing with wind speeds of 40 miles an hour, temperatures of 20 below. So you're actually talking about very poor wintering range for wildlife. And that is the common, that's the kind of the weak link on the chain, is their wintering area. Our wintering area has flowers blooming on January 5th. We have good grass, even in the winter, and it's that steep, deep canyons. Yellowstone being at 6,000 feet, our low elevation canyons, 1,800 feet, plenty of cover. It's basically the greatest winter wildlife haven in North America.
Now, do you mean like Hell's Canyon when you say
yes,
that?
It's called the West Central Idaho Deep Canyon Complex. Mm-hmm. The only other one that exists in North America is by the Colorado River in Grand Canyon. However, ours are deeper, lower elevation, and they receive more moisture. And so where one is a deep canyon cutting through desert, ours is a deep canyon cutting through grassland and forest.
So live out in the winter, you said, backpacking. Tell us, did you really? I mean, you don't just go out to, let's say, a canyon outside of Riggins, set up a camera, and then go back to the Riggins motel.
Yeah.
That's
no,
what I would do.
No,
that's definitely.
Here's
what I
found. This is another interesting. What I found is that there's a direct correlation to what kind of exciting photographs you get and access to roads. And I wish it, you know, for ease, it would have been nice if it was the other way around. But if there is a dirt road, a snowmobile trail, or anything that you can get to, you're more likely to get deer, fox, and people and their equipment. If you walk at least 2 days through steep slopes, you're more likely to get a mother lion playing with its kittens. You're more likely to get those exciting scenes because they are driven to that area. And it's just a trend I saw in the first 6 months. And so the second year and a half, I was like, all cameras need to be on the most painful, difficult slopes. Thus, I'd have to go and usually spend at least 7 to 15 days out.
Wow.
Maintaining the cameras. I'd have to go to one 2 or 3 day remote slope and then go to the next one. And what I was doing was fixing the cameras, recharging the batteries, checking, you know, putting a new card in. And so in general, I would spend 10 or 15 days out and then go back 2 or 3 days back in civilization, mm-hmm. recharging batteries, writing, gathering the data, trying to decide what is the next scene I need to capture.
Is this all stuff you're able to put on your back, or do you have to drag something along?
Yeah, I had to put it on my back. And so all winter camping was done without a tent. And that shows you how mild and engaging our winter in the low canyons are. Because I was bringing camera equipment out, I had to skimp somewhere else. You know, humans can only carry a certain percentage of their weight. I was limited to about 40 pounds. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I needed a sleeping bag that would keep me warm even when wet, and I needed enough food for that time. Mm-hmm. After that, next important was batteries and camera equipment, and the weight of a tent just never came in. I could never do it. So basically, And I have to admit, it was not, I did not suffer. It was beautiful. I enjoyed it.
Now, when it comes to which direction you went, again, I'm focused on McCall because that's what we all know is the most obvious place in this area. If I were to go east of McCall, I would think it would get pretty cold and snowy and tough in that direction. But if I go north and a little west of McCall, then I'm in this Hell's Canyon area in Riggins where the elevation is low and it's always warmer in the winter than it is. Is that the area you're talking about where you've done most of your filming?
Also east of McCall, though, because, okay, you're correct. What you're talking about is elevation change more
right.
so than direction.
Yeah.
So your northwest section is in the Hell's Canyon area, 1,800 feet. There are canyons there that are shallow. I basically did a 30-mile radius around McCall to kind of hit all areas. But what's more important is the elevation of the photographs. In the winter, the low elevation, steep, inaccessible, no snowmobile access, nothing. That's where I photographed. And going east of McCall is cold and snowy until you pass that first peak, and then you drop into the South Fork of the Salmon. And the South Fork of the Salmon is so low that there's hardly any snow on the ground, and it's sort of like Hell's Canyon. And so it really doesn't matter which direction you go as long as you stay nearby. The question is, are you going low and are you on a south-facing or a north-facing slope? Because even low down, the north-facing slopes are covered in snow and spruce.
Right. So the cover of your book has a mountain lion that is looking right into one of your cameras. I'm looking at a photo of a couple of bears playing in some grassland. Did you protect yourself somehow? Do you have a gun in that pack or
no, that's
bear spray? How about bear spray?
I do own bear spray from camping in northern Montana.
Yeah.
I did not, after the first month, I did not bring the bear spray out with me, no gun. And that was another weight issue. And also, our animals are well hunted, and therefore they have the natural fear of humans. It's unnatural, really, when an animal is not scared of man. Right? On this continent, we've had hunters for about 15,000 years at minimum. Animals are scared of humans. Mm-hmm. So I never had any issue. And it's a question that comes up a lot because I know a lot of, one of the biggest interest groups in this, obviously naturalists have taken to it, but the hunting community has had a fascination that almost surpasses the naturalists, the way they dissect the book and look through it and ask questions. And one of their first questions is, or comments is, you're crazy for doing this without a gun or bear mace. Mm-hmm. The wolves, some of the bears, the birds, I had to photograph via scope. Mm-hmm. The wolves are almost all scope photographs. They are terrified of these little cameras. So
the wolves, you say?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The lion looking into the camera was a fortunate accident in that the lions are near impossible to photograph by hand. However, they are intelligent and curious. And the little click of the camera causes them to linger just a little bit to be photographed.
Very interesting.
Wolves, the dog family, are nervous, trap nervous. It's so ingrained. So the second there's a click, they flip out and jump out of the camera range. So the wolves I had to camouflage and photograph with scope, find kills and so forth.
You're listening to Matthew Darin. He is the author of A Forgotten Wilderness, Nature's Hidden Relationship in West Central Idaho, one of the most fascinating books I've seen and read in a number of years. Matthew, take us through how the camera work actually unfolds when you're out in the middle of nowhere. You're not just using one camera?
8 motion sensor cameras.
So every one of those 8 cameras is set up in a specific area?
Yeah.
Boy, you're not going to miss them that way, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. The reason why the motion sensor cameras are important is that what I felt was this area is so important that it was important to do a nature book that is different from every other nature and photography book. So what I wanted to do in this book was have every photograph actually be indicative of the animal, kind of a hidden scene of it actually living in the plants and the ecosystems that it raises. So the motion cameras were absolutely critical to tell the honest story of nature for this area. And what I would do is find the scene and location that represents a certain habitat. In other words, the mountain lions live in the ponderosa pines in winter. They don't live in open fields or anything like that. So I needed to photograph lions in winter in front of the virgin ponderosa pine forests. So I'd find the kind of setting I wanted, make sure the lions were coming through by tracking them in the snow, set up two or three cameras per location so that I wouldn't miss the right angle, and then leave it for two or three weeks.
So now, how did you know, forgive the dumb question, but again, even though you're an environmental engineer, how did you pull down this information about where do you go to find a mountain lion in the Ponderosa pines in the winter?
Failure,
I see.
So this is all based on field experience. The mountain lion is the key to this ecosystem. This is one of the few areas where we have enough land for our large carnivore. How do I find it? I probably spent the first year, you know, I've been doing this kind of naturalist work for 20 years. The first 4 years, I was looking for mountain lion tracks in exactly the wrong area. Deep snow up on high slopes, I was clueless.
Yeah.
But by failure, you start to hone down to the point where when I set my first camera up, I got a mountain lion within 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 5 years of experience. Finally, I knew where they were. And that's how the process for the entire book went. I spent 2 years living outside photographing, 1 year writing and editing the story. But the previous 17 years were essentially doing the field work that can get me every photograph I need in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like the Zen archer holding the bow, where the teacher makes the student hold the bow for 5 years before he's allowed to pull an arrow. Hold it correctly, breathe correctly. But when he pulls the bow the first time, the arrow hits the target.
How far away were you setting up from where you lay? So you go there and you lay the cameras down and you set them up. But if you're too close to those cameras, that's not going to work. So you must have had, do you have to travel a fairly long distance after you set up the cameras to get away from it all, where you bed down for the night or whatever you're going to do?
Yes. What I do is I'd set up the cameras. I would use charcoal. I'd descent my hands. Every trip was a hand shot and remote camera shot. So I'd set up the remote cameras. Then I would move a mile away and verbally call in wolves to photograph them. Or I'd go tracking, looking for a kill to photograph. Or I'd say, I need this bird that comes down from the Arctic in the winter, and I'd look for it or set up. The wolves were the only ones where I would do full camouflage, again with charcoal. It descents and it also takes away the shine of your skin. And I would just lay in the spot where I knew that they had pups, or I knew that they were their rendezvous sites, or I'd camouflage where I heard them, call them in. Wolves always respond to a human imitating their voice. They just need to see what kind of competition comes in. Now, they're very alert when they come in. Sometimes you miss them and you don't realize you have three wolves looking at you. So I probably had to call them in 20 times before I got two or three shots.
It's like a howl, I suppose?
Yeah, it's a howl in three different pitches. The more accurate you replicate them, the further away they come and the more times they're likely to come. Even a poor imitation will usually call them in. They just want to make sure that there's no... And they're coming in for competition. They're not coming in to say hello.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming to see who's infringing on our area.
How about the coyote? How do you get them around?
The coyotes are something that are more willing to be seen. They're a little less nervous. So the coyotes, I didn't really need to call them in. The wolves are kind of a larger, more intelligent, more secretive animal. But the coyotes will answer you as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a more high-pitched howl. They'll answer you at night. A lot of times in the lonely snow and rain at night, the only company that I had that made me feel good at night was listening to the wolves talk to each other or the coyotes.
Wow. Given the unique nature of this book, are there competitions where you could place this book to get some recognition, official recognition or award?
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole intent originally. When I discussed with the funders, the DeBoer family, the Brundage Resort owners, the entire point of the book was, in a really tasteful, accurate way, to represent what's unique about the area. And we really wanted to do it in a way that the book reflected how unique the area was. And so the part we haven't even talked about yet was the text. Each page is a relationship, a connection that can enlighten or enhance someone's experience that you wouldn't find in a nature book. A lot of times it's canned material. Both the photograph of the grizzly is canned, because there's no story behind it besides that it's habituated to a parking lot. And on a second level, the information, the grizzly bear has a gestation period of 8 months, and they're facts that you can find in any book. Every page in here is a relationship that you'll not really find in a nature book. It's kind of boils down, what is the true pattern instead of an inundating fact? So, you know, in answer to your question, we went through every effort to have this book unique in every single way, and we do feel that it is actually one of the first nature books that is written for the audience directly by the ridges and valleys. In other words, there's no photographer or author or naturalist adding their experience in the way. And by experience, I mean not experience in reading patterns, experience as in this is my personal growth as a naturalist. All the interesting stories doing the photo is out. That's a different book. Mm-hmm. This is a book that takes the direct patterns of nature and connects directly with the audience with no interference, mm-hmm. no ego of a photographer or naturalist.
You know, in education, we talk about experiential learning, where you take the student out of the boring classroom mm-hmm. and you put them in the real life experience, whatever it is. This book is almost like taking someone, whether it's an mm-hmm. adult or a child, on a trip,
yep.
on the trip through the West Central Mountains.
Yeah.
And Matthew's going to be your tour guide here.
Yeah.
And one by one, you're going to take apart the whole ecosystem through your experiences and what you've seen with these cameras.
You are completely right. I'm glad you brought that up, because if I had to just do a sum takeaway goal for the book, it's we only have 176 pages to inspire, educate, and show someone the true patterns that they need personally in order to go on their journey. It's a nature primer. These are the 176 pages that we would put out. And ideally, I want people to forget about, after they start seeing the patterns and start mastering some, I want them to forget about the book and forget about me, because this is really only just like the beginning primer. And yes, and that's another aspect of not only why our area is unique, but why the book is unique. And, you know, that's the exciting part. That to me, at book signings, my favorite thing is when someone comes up just to tell me that they lived in Idaho their whole life. They hunted, they lived, they had a mine house or a ranch house, and that this book more accurately reflected the area that they grew up in than anything they've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And they loved it and they have an emotional connection. Then we did our job right. We hit the goal. Myself and the Brundage Resort did what we wanted to do on it. People also will congratulate me on, you know, you did a great job. It's well written. Those are great photographs. It's of far lesser importance than the emotional connection that each person has when they read it.
Have you been able to attract the interest of people outside of Idaho when it comes to book signings, when it comes to reviews of the book up and down the West Coast, for example?
The best book review just recently came out from an ex-professor from Berkeley who read the book in San Francisco. His article is called Passionate Indifference, mm-hmm. The passion of nature, but yet the indifference of it. And we also have some East Coast sales via the internet. So initially, they don't even care that it's about Idaho. They live in an area where there's very little natural areas. Everything's owned and private. They need to know there's a place in the country that is as wild as it was 2,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. There's a book in McCall that I'm in the middle of right now that's about the owl, and I think it's the great horned owl, but I'm not sure, in Long Valley. Mm-hmm. And it's a story of how it's almost gone, that you can hardly find them anymore. And this guy is lamenting the fact that the ecosystem has changed mm-hmm. and the habitat for this owl is mm-hmm. now gone. From your experience doing this book, are there any warning signals, is there anything you walked away with like, yeah, this is a great ecosystem, but it's changing and it's threatened? And if so, any particular ways in which there's an immediate threat to what you were able to document in this book?
Well, I think the book that you're talking about is about the great gray owl.
The great gray owl, that's
and,
right.
And yeah, it's a really fascinating owl. I did like the book. Mm-hmm. And I think that he was lamenting it leaving, I can't be sure, leaving certain areas of his study areas. Because I will say the owl does seem to be doing well. There's a lot of, I have a lot of photographs in the book and also a lot more that there weren't room for. Mm-hmm. They're basically a very quiet owl of the boreal forest, the deep north, the Canadian owl. And our area, everywhere where there's a meadow, surrounded by spruces, there tends to be one of these owl pairs. However, the Forest Service is studying whether they are declining. But at least during the book, I was able to find a fair number of them. Do I notice any changes? I'll tell you one positive thing I notice is that the bark beetle, the big die-off on trees that is occurring, seems to be hitting the drier areas farther to our east more so than us. And I talk about this in the book a little bit. That extra rainfall that we get, the extra moisture, really seems to be boosting the immune system of the trees. Now, I'm not qualified to make a statement on there, but I will say the forests east of us are turning brown very rapidly. Ours are still vibrant and green. Now, it could just be a matter of time. You know, I wouldn't want to make a statement that a silviculturist or a forest ecology expert would say is not true. But I just noticed that we still have a pretty strong as an ecosystem gets.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way the pine bark beetle, I've asked this question on the air already in another show we did, but there isn't any critter out there. You mentioned, for example, that the chickadee and one other bird was busy eating these bugs on trees.
Right.
And as I read that, I thought, well, you know, why can't they deal with the pine bark beetle? But I guess it's because the beetles underneath the tree are inside the tree. Is that right?
Right. That's right. It's never one thing or another. It's a whole conglomeration. So in the past, we had much colder winters that were killing a fair number of the pine bark beetles. We also had cleaner air quality that boosted the immune system of the trees. We had less logging and more continuous forest. So the woodpeckers all did better, which are the ones that would both drill for the insects and make homes for the other insects. So it's kind of all these things together. And what eliminates these devastations is when four or five factors drop off. We could handle if the winters weren't cold. We could handle if the woodpeckers weren't doing as well. But when you take all four combinations, that's when you go to Stanley and you look and you see that it looks like fall in Pennsylvania.
Oh,
every spruce is dead. And that's where I said we are tipping the balance right now just because we have better climate, more moisture, greater wildlife variety.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had all kinds of questions about aspen groves and about elk and magpies sitting on top of them doing their job and antelope, but we ran out of time.
Yeah.
But here's the good news. People can go buy the book, right?
Exactly.
This is just an incredible accomplishment, Matthew, and I'm delighted to have you on the show. I do want to thank Judd DeBoer for calling your book to my attention. And Judd, of course, is the reason why this book is in print.
Right.
In addition to your writing it, of course, and doing all the work.
Yeah, it would just be two-thirds done on my computer and me talking about it in coffee shops. And
The DeBoer family and all they've done at Brundage Mountain and River Ranch and now this book, we just want to thank them for the role they played in getting us to this point. And again, congratulations to you for writing the book. Continued success. One more question. Are you going to have another book? You're going to do something else like this, do you think? Or
I don't know.
Yeah. It's kind of hard finding another unique spot like this, right? I mean, that's tough.
Right. The ultimate goal was for people to read the book, have it enlighten them about nature, and then forget about the book.
So
if I write another one, they'll read that one.
And the name of the book, A Forgotten Wilderness, Nature's Hidden Relationship in West Central Idaho by Matthew Darren. Thanks again, Matthew, for joining us today.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Matthew Darren. Next week, Parag Khanna, author of How to Run the World, Charting the Course to the Next Renaissance. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.